You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Monday, September 24th, 2012, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jane Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good morning and or good evening.
How is everyone today?
Super.
Doing just
fine. Thanks for asking.
Hey, happy CERN Day, everybody. Happy
Ooh.
CERN Day.
What does that mean?
That means on September 29th, 1954, the convention establishing CERN was signed. CERN, of course, being the European Organization for Nuclear Research. That's the English equivalent. I'm not going to attempt the French because I don't want to get angry emails.
Rebecca, I was concerned that you'd forget.
That I'd forget? That it's CERN Day?
Yeah, I was concerned.
Yes.
Nothing.
Well,
huh? Okay.
Certainly, that's not an issue.
You mean that my joke was so bad that I'm hurting for certain?
All right. So this is also the one-year anniversary, or at least September 24th when we're recording this, of the first SGU 24-hour live broadcast.
Oh, boy. That was awesome.
Remember that?
Have you guys recovered yet?
Has it only been a year?
Yeah.
Seems like yesterday.
Barely.
Evan, we don't need sleep, right? It's overrated.
Yeah. I'll sleep when I'm dead.
I think that was the hardest project I ever did in my life.
It was a test
well,
of endurance, until
that baby
will,
comes out.
And-
Yeah, I, well, yeah, that's, right. So far, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Every convention people come up to me like, what, you doing another SGU 24? And I always say, you know what? I wouldn't mind doing it again, but I don't think we can convince anybody else to do it. And I tell everyone, well, maybe we'll do like an SGU 6 hours or 4 hours or something like that. And I think if we ever do it, that's what it would have to be.
SGU 4 hours is a normal night of recording for us.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, yeah, actually it is.
Rebecca, have you checked out the Ig Nobel winners for 2012?
I have indeed, actually. I'm sad that I no longer live in Boston because Ig Nobels were my favorite time of year. If you ever get a chance to actually go and see them in person, I highly recommend it. It's a hilarious evening of science and fun. So yeah, this year's winners, much like previous years, are absolutely delightful. So for those of our listeners who aren't familiar with the Ig Nobels, the idea is that they give out awards to science that first makes you laugh and then makes you think. Some Ig Nobels are occasionally given out tongue-in-cheek to idiots and pseudoscientists, but for the most part, they're given out to actual scientists doing actual scientific research that is completely ridiculous. So, for instance, this year, the Psychology Prize went to two scientists for their study, leaning to the left makes the Eiffel Tower seem smaller.
As opposed to the right, I suppose.
My personal favorite prize was the Acoustics Prize, which went to two Japanese researchers who created something called the Speech Jammer, which is the most brilliant device, I think, that has ever been created. And it's something that, when I describe it, will be immediately familiar to everybody currently on this show, because this is something that anybody who deals with audio who has spoken into a microphone while wearing headphones and had something go wrong, you know exactly what this does. So the Speech Jammer disrupts a person's speech by forcing them to hear their own words at a very slight delay. So basically what it is it's a large gun that looks kind of like, and I've seen it referred to as an Xbox-like device. And there's a microphone on it. You point it at someone who is talking, and the microphone picks up their words and then delays what they're saying by a few hundred milliseconds and then feeds it back out through a speaker directly at them. And everything is direction sensitive so that the speaker is the only person who can really get the effect.
Are they aware that they're hearing their voice on a delay?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure they are, but there's a video showing it in action, and there's one part of the video focuses on a professor, and he's giving a lecture at the front of the room, and somebody does it to him. And he kind of freaks out because he thinks that something in the lecture hall is going wrong, like his microphone is messed up or the projector is messing something up. It really makes him stop talking like immediately. It's so difficult to listen to yourself echoing while continuing to talk.
Have you guys ever experienced that?
That's
what it does. Yeah,
this all the time.
During the SGU 24 show when we were doing interviews.
Oh God, that's
right.
There
was that half a second delay and it was almost impossible to talk. You had to take the headphones off.
Yeah.
In order to get a sentence out.
Yeah, it was hard. You become hyper aware of what you're saying and you're completely unable to function.
That's funny, Steve. What's going on in the brain at that point? So the brain is, you're trying to create speech and at the same time interpret, your brain is also at the same time interpreting its own speech and trying to
make
it fit together.
I think it just can't process two speech streams at the same time. So
I think it's a little more complicated than that though, because I mean, one of the things that people do by instinct is we're able to filter out ambient noise. And so if you're in a room with 5 or 10 or more people talking, you can kind of just ignore it, but you can't ignore that. It's something different
voice about
it. You can't ignore it. You can't just sweep it aside like you can other speech. It's something that just like short circuits your brain.
And hearing yourself so close to the words that you've just spoken, right? And the timing, I'm sure, is
the timing is part.
They've honed in the timing to be effective in this regard.
Yeah, I wonder if you slowly increase the delay, what the effect would be? Would you reach a threshold where you could totally deal with it? I probably could.
Absolutely, Bob. It was a sweet spot, and they figured out the sweet spot. Then they figured out the delivery mechanism, like how to shoot that sound back at one person or to a very small area. So it is kind of like a gun, right, Rebecca?
Yeah. Yeah. It looks like a big chunky gun with a microphone and a speaker on it.
But the funny thing about this is that there really isn't any point to it other than what? Like, is it just a prank?
Well, yeah, I mean, in the abstract, they say, we discuss practical application scenarios of the system, such as facilitating and controlling discussions, which is just a polite, sciencey way to say making people shut up. A bunch of kids, you know, studying in a lab, and a girl pulls out her cell phone and starts talking, and somebody pulls out the gun, and she just immediately stops.
Has to stop.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think everybody can think of a million practical applications for this item.
Oh, yeah.
Just maybe not so much in the terms of furthering human evolution or knowledge of the universe.
I think we talked about the neuroscience prize on the show.
We
before,
did.
Didn't? Yeah.
Yeah. And it surprised me because I assumed that these guys got the prize years earlier because this study came out in 2009. It's the study that shows that you can pick up meaningful brain activity using fMRI from absolutely anything, even a dead salmon. So these researchers stuck a dead salmon in an fMRI and found what they would classify as meaningful brain activity, which really is a fantastic study because it throws into disarray so many previous studies that, you know, claim to show really amazing results by finding, you know, certain spots in the brain that are meant to be certain types of thought and things like that. This sort of throws all that out the window in a way because it makes you realize that brain researchers, unfortunately, can quite easily just see what they want to see in fMRI results sometimes.
But there was a very specific statistical argument that they made. It doesn't necessarily invalidate all fMRI research, just those that use poor technique. Now, what specifically they were saying is that because you're looking at so much information with fMRI, you can number crunch tons of comparisons, and it becomes almost a certainty that you will find false positives among those comparisons, unless you correct for multiple comparisons. You do a statistical fix for multiple analysis. So if you do the proper statistical analysis, then the results can still be robust and statistically legitimate. But it's also just trivially easy to produce false positives by failing to do that basic statistical correction. And you know that's something that we see all the time, not just in fMRI studies. It's just that the number of comparisons that you can do with this kind of data is so huge that it particularly lends itself to this particular statistical error.
Yep.
Got it?
Got it.
I was also particularly impressed with the literature prize. I'm going to read directly from the Ig Nobel description of it. The U.S. Government General Accountability Office won for issuing a report about reports about reports that recommends the preparation of a report about the report about reports about reports.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Bureaucracy.
The Fluid Dynamics Prize went to some researchers who studied how your coffee sloshes around when you walk. Walking with coffee, why does it spill?
Mm-hmm. That's why they invented lids.
The Anatomy Prize went to faces and behinds, chimpanzee sex perception. These researchers from the Netherlands and the US found that chimpanzees can identify other chimps from seeing photographs of their butts. The Medicine Prize was terrifying. It went to two French researchers who did some research advising doctors who perform colonoscopies how to minimize the chance that their patients will explode.
Mm-hmm. What?
The paper was called Colonic Gas Explosion During Therapeutic Colonoscopy with Electrocautery. Steve, your butt can explode during a colonoscopy? That is terrifying.
I think Jay has actually more expertise in this area than I do.
Yes, Jay. You're a violent colon.
Well, just because I do what my doctor says. I mean, he says it's time to go get an exam. I get the exam. What am I going to say? No.
That wasn't my point.
That's not where he's going.
Because this has
that.
To do with explosive gas that builds up in your colon. And that gas can get to a sufficient concentration to be explosive. And then you can trigger it with electrocautery. A little spark can actually ignite the methane that builds up in your colon and explode it. It doesn't have to be a big explosion to cause some serious damage.
Why would you do that?
Why would you? I don't think they're doing it on purpose, Jay.
Yeah, no, but after it happens like once, you figure they'd stop doing it, right?
No, stop doing colonoscopy with electrocautery.
I mean,
it's a rare complication. So what they're essentially saying, just do a really good prep, a good colonic cleansing before you do colonoscopy with electrocautery to minimize the chance of explosion.
Holy crap. How could I never, ever hear of that?
Don't you wish you could unhear it?
I'm terrified.
No, I want to see a videotape of it.
There's something wrong with you guys. That is not cool.
Steve, does that kill them?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. It's a horrible way to die.
How embarrassing. Wow. What did your brother die from? Well, he was getting an exam and his whole ass blew up. I mean, seriously.
Well, hopefully it won't happen as much anymore thanks to the Ig Nobel winners.
So apparently there were 20 cases of colonic gas explosion identified in the literature. 9 of them were complicated by colon perforation.
Like it was perforated before?
No, the explosion caused perforation.
Oh.
Well, yeah, I would think. At the minimum. Yeah.
One of those was fatal, so one person died. Well, thanks, Rebecca. The Ig Nobels are always fascinating. So this next study that we're going to talk about didn't win an Ig Nobel, maybe for next year. But this has got to be one of the worst studies I've run across in a long time. The number of different specific criticisms I've come across of this study is staggering. Have you guys heard? This has been actually quite prominent in the media. This is one of those studies that numerous listeners have emailed us about. The French study looking at the effects of GM corn in rats, concluding that the Roundup Ready GM corn increases the risk of getting tumors. Have you guys heard about this?
No.
How could we not? It was everywhere.
Yeah, it was everywhere. The researchers said that this is alarming. Obviously, the GM corn can be increasing the risk of breast cancer in women and in other tumors. Based upon this study, the French media seemed to completely buy their alarmism, based upon this research. But the American media was pretty skeptical from the get-go, but they didn't really give a good impression of how horrible this study was. The thing that was most suspicious in the initial reporting was the fact that the researchers would not allow... So it's very typical to send out a press release about a news item and to embargo it until a certain time, just so you give the reporters a chance to look it over and write their story, and then at a certain date and time, then you can publish the news story. And this gives the scientists an opportunity to do a press conference or whatever it is they're doing. Of course, if you violate the embargo, you're probably not going to be given future pre-releases of press releases. In any case, what the researchers did was they sent the embargoed press release to the media, but they specifically prohibited journalists from seeking outside comment on the paper before it was published.
That's outside the norm.
That was very unusual. So they basically told journalists, here's our research, we want you to report on it, but we don't want you to do your job as journalists and ask anybody else what they think about it. Just publish our interpretation of our own study.
Wow.
That's amazing that can even happen.
Yeah.
Can
a journalist
do that?
Well, it's what do you mean by make them? You know,
make them sign a say you can come and listen to this, but
the beauty of an embargo is that they can't enforce it at all. All they can do is if a journalist breaks the embargo, they can go on a shit list and then they never get the tip-offs again.
Well, who cares if they're on their shit list?
Well,
and for a piece of crap like this.
It matters, unfortunately, it matters to a lot of journalists, particularly the overworked type I'm imagining at, you know, larger newspapers who are mostly just printing press releases and things and don't really have time to dig into this stuff and don't really have much interest in pissing off the people who are feeding them the easy science news.
Yeah, you know, right.
But that said, there are plenty of journalists who do break embargoes because of things like that. I know Ben Goldacre has tweeted some of the idiotic things that researchers will do with embargoes that journalists happily say, you know, go screw yourself to.
Yeah. So. Yeah, it's all honor system, but of course, if you don't care about the particular institution or researchers, you know, you're under no obligation to follow the embargo. In this case, I would have told them to screw off and just, you know, did what I normally do, you know. But it didn't take long for scientific news outlets like The New Scientist and science bloggers to be all over this study, and there was just an avalanche of withering criticism. For example, here are some of the specific criticisms of the study. The population of rats that they use have a high propensity for tumors. It's really easy to get them to have tumors. One way to get them to have tumors is to overfeed them, and the researchers didn't indicate the total food intake for any of their groups.
Interesting.
There were only 20 rats in the control group, and they had a lower tumor rate than is historically typical for this population of rats.
Group.
Yeah. The control group had an artificially low rate of tumors. The data only reported that some of the test groups had a higher tumor incidence while others did not. So they essentially cherry-picked the data that showed a higher incidence. And in fact, there was one group that showed a lower incidence with the highest amount of GM corn. There was no dose response. So there was no relationship between how much corn they ate and the risk of tumor. They also looked at exposure to Roundup, the herbicide, which had the same effect as eating the corn that had the gene that was resistant to the herbicide, which makes no sense. That's such completely different mechanisms to produce the same effect. They did not control for fungal contaminants, something else that also can cause tumors in the same population of rats. And they did not use standard statistical analysis. Instead, they used some completely made-up, unusual statistical analysis that Tom Sanders, who's a researcher, characterized it as a statistical fishing trip in The New Scientist.
Holy crap.
Ouch.
This ended up in a peer-reviewed journal.
Yes. Amazingly, yes. This is just the tip of the iceberg. I mean, every time somebody else takes a look at it, they're like, oh my God, look what else they did. You know, there were just so many other problems with this study. The study is uninterpretable and utter nonsense.
Was it
maybe
done on purpose?
Maybe
was it
they're
done
having
on
a
purpose?
Joke on all of us.
Yeah. No, you'd like to think that, but no.
So what's the result going to be, Stephen? What happens to these people?
Well, they're getting roundly criticized. I don't know why anybody would take them seriously. These researchers are suspect right out of the gate. You know, they are part of a group that has been highly critical of GM crops ahead of time, so they have an ideological axe to grind. They've produced previous studies that were highly criticized as flawed and totally biased against GM food. And one of the researchers, and this may explain how horrifically bad their research methods were, one of the researchers is a homeopath.
Oh, boy.
What?
Yeah.
No way.
Yeah. Dr. Joel Spiro de Vendemois, which I probably totally butchered, is a homeopath. He's a doctor of homeopathy and acupuncture.
What?
So they have a feng shui specialist on this team as
so
well?
So which means he's an expert in manipulating data and generating false positives out of crap.
You've got a degree in baloney.
You have a degree in baloney. Yeah, so that's what we're dealing with. Now, apparently, the French media ate it up. And they were like, oh, see how horrible GM food is. It's going to kill us, everybody. You know, it's horrible.
But now they're
later than other countries, than English-speaking countries, they're starting to pick up on the fact that maybe this study is not something to hang your hat on. You know, so they're sort of catching the second cycle and then trying to make up for their initial utter failure in reporting how crappy this study was.
Scusi, mille regretti.
French, not Italian.
I know, but I know how to say that in Italian. It's a movie quote.
Right. So I mean, this doesn't say anything about GM food. This is we had a previous discussion about this on the show. It's a complicated topic, and you know, it gets into the precautionary principle, the environmental effects, and there's also all of the dealings that Monsanto and other corporations like that do in terms of controlling their seed and how they treat farmers and whatnot. But regardless of what you think about all of that, this one study is utter crap. And there really isn't any evidence for any health risks from eating this particular GM corn. You know, it has a gene inserted in there that gives it resistance to Roundup. So it's a so-called Roundup-ready crop, so that farmers could then spray their fields with Roundup in one application to get rid of weeds, and it won't affect the crop. So it's very cost effective. There hasn't been any evidence that it causes any. I mean, it's been studied sufficiently to get approval for human consumption. It's safe. So when you have something that's been studied to this degree is probably being consumed by millions or hundreds of millions of people, really you're going to do a crappy little study with 20 control rats, and then try to alarm the world about, you know, the risks of this product. That's just completely irresponsible.
What does this say about the Food and Chemical Toxicology Journal? Does a journal like this,
it's a peer review fail. Total peer review fail.
Yeah. Does this put them in a bad light, essentially?
Absolutely.
For future.
It turns them into a scientific rag. I mean, this is, it shows that their editorial filter and peer review filter is inadequate. You know, this never should have been published. This study is a joke.
Yeah, but still, people will be citing this study that has been for years. It was citing, hey, this was in a peer-reviewed journal. And lots of people won't remember that it was shit.
You may be right, but I will say there was such a science blogger feeding frenzy over this study that I wonder if that is going to stick. That was that crappy study that was shot down in flames within hours of being published.
But this came out like 20 years ago before the internet. What would have happened?
Yeah.
This thing would have gotten out there and been out there so long before anyone had a chance to really pull it apart the way we have.
Oh, I know. The turnaround was really quick. Within a day or two, it was shredded on the internet. So you're right. I think that's one of the good positive things about the internet was the speed with which this kind of information could be turned over.
Good job, internet.
All right, well, let's go on to another interesting news item. Jay, you're going to tell us about HIV and faith healing.
According to a charity called the African Health Policy Network, or AHPN, 7 separate groups said that there were multiple instances of people being told by religious leaders that they had been healed through prayer. And then they were pressured to stop taking their antiretroviral medication, which is horrifying if you think about. And a lot of events like this were reported happening in Finsbury Park, Tottenham, Woolwich, which are in London, and in Manchester, Leeds, and in several other churches across the Northwest. So this is something that's actually becoming more and more common, or not common, but at least being found out about at this point. The last year, the BBC London confirmed that there were 3 people with HIV who died after they stopped taking their antiretroviral drugs because their evangelical Christian pastors advised them to do so. The AHPN then requested that the government do more to prevent faith leaders that are encouraging the people that are attending their church to stop taking their drugs. They need the government to get involved with this because it's going out of control.
Yeah, those people need to be arrested and jailed for the rest of their goddamn lives. That's horrific.
Yeah, it is. I think this is where you really draw the line. Like, you know, it's fine. People can believe what they want. They can worship what they want. But when you start to crisscross science and then you start to crisscross people's actual health and well-being, you know, I think that something needs to be done about this. The AHPN said the cases reported to it by the community group showed the following. So let me read this list to you. That most respondents were aware of more than one case of faith healing claims and pressure to stop taking medication. One member was aware of 5 cases. Many followers believed the testimony of pastors who claimed they could heal them. The majority of cases reported involved evangelical or Pentecostal Christian pastors. And in some cases, treatment had been restarted. In others, the health and mental health of clients had declined. So the church members who reported being exposed to faith healers were very unfortunate. They were unwilling to name the churches involved.
But it's one thing to be told that you're healed. It's another one to be told specifically, do not take your medicine.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Isn't that some kind of depraved indifference or reckless endangerment or something?
Yeah. I mean, the bottom line is that the people that are asking their attendees to stop taking the medication probably do believe, which isn't an excuse, but they probably do believe that it's the right thing for them to do and that God will heal them. The problem here is that when people in their communities die from HIV, nobody changes their mind. I mean, we have examples of people dying from not taking their medicine and nobody's saying, hey,
Jay,
you know what?
Jay, their faith wasn't strong enough.
Yeah.
Well, we even see that in the HIV denial community. I mean, these are people who steadfastly believe that HIV does not lead to AIDS, and several of their most prominent outspoken advocates are dead from AIDS, and they just refuse to admit it.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's amazing how once committed to, you know, an ideology like that, no matter how ridiculous, they can hold to it steadfastly in the face of vast amounts of evidence to the contrary.
That's the power of belief. That's the power in the need to believe in something.
And also, I think that it's made worse by the fact that we're talking about HIV/AIDS because it's not that you don't die of AIDS, you know, necessarily. Right. Oh, he died of pneumonia.
Yeah.
Or you know, they can pass it off as something else and pretend as though AIDS had nothing to do with it.
It's right. Well, the worst aspect of this is how many additional people are getting infected by people who believe they've been cured through faith healing.
Yeah.
Oh, I think
right. there's collateral damage now too.
We have to take a stand in our societies here. You know, we can't allow people to believe in things to the detriment of those that don't know any better. How else can I put it? There has to be laws put in place, very, very strict laws that regardless of what your belief system, you have to not only adhere to what the latest and greatest science says about medicine, but that, you know, like people have to receive their medication. You can't advise people to do things that goes against our better knowledge.
So you're living a fantasy life.
Well, you know what, Steve? So I realize
a dictatorship.
Yeah, it just violates too many principles of autonomy, and people are not gonna go for that. And you know, the downside of what you're proposing, I understand where you're coming from, but you can't just say, all right, we're gonna force treatment upon you against your will, and you can't make decisions based upon your faith. Unfortunately, adults can make stupid decisions for themselves based upon whatever crazy notion that they have. You know, we have to be much more nuanced and careful if we're going to try to minimize the damage to society from people who make dumb healthcare decisions for themselves.
Like, and I think the solution is more prosecuting the people who are spreading this information, this misinformation from the top down, the people at the pulpit who are preaching this. I think at that point, there is a possibility. I'm trying to think of what the word is for, you have free speech, but you can't yell fire in a crowded right. theater.
Yeah, that's the only way you could go about it. I'm not saying that you should arrest people that aren't taking their medication. What I'm saying is that there should be strict responsibility and consequences to people that are spreading this misinformation. And also, Steve, listen, they're taking advantage in a horrible way. These people are being taken advantage of by those that they trust.
So, but how is that compatible with freedom of religion, though?
It's compatible with freedom of religion, but you know, Steve, should people be so free that they can harm themselves in this way?
People have the right to harm themselves.
But not others.
But not others. So that's where it becomes the only real angle I think we have with these kind of things is public health. We could say this is a public health issue. And if you're documented HIV positive, you know, there are certain public health measures that now you are obligated to take, such as, for example, being in a treatment program. Right. I mean, we could just say that the public interest of health outweigh your autonomy in this regard. It's like vaccinations.
And there have also been prosecutions for people with HIV AIDS who knowingly have unprotected sex with partners and don't tell them that they're infected.
What if that person believed they were cured by a faith healer and then had unprotected sex with a partner? Would that, so now I would agree with Jay in that case, that they're still liable. They're still guilty.
Yeah. I mean, I could see your point.
Could believe it for yourself, but you can't believe it for other people.
I don't want to take this to the point where we're stripping people of their freedoms. I think what we're trying to do, it's like a seatbelt law. We're trying to protect people from lack of knowledge, stupidity, not understanding things. You know, some things seem obvious to some people. Put your seatbelt on. It takes 2 seconds and then you forget about it and you'll never think about it again during that car ride. And other people don't want to wear their seatbelt. But why do we have seatbelt laws? Why do we have helmet laws? You know, I know that it's a much more obvious thing, but this is pretty obvious to a lot of people that you need to take your medication when you have HIV. If you test positive for HIV, you need to take that medication. End of discussion. And it's worse, Steve, because you could spread this. This is something that you can give to other people. This isn't like you just riding a motorcycle without a helmet. This is, you're carrying a disease.
No, this is almost like driving drunk, you know.
Yeah.
You're putting other people at risk.
Yeah.
Now, it is a public health issue, and that's the angle that can allow there to be some regulation that mitigates this sort of thing. But you can't just, you know, ride roughshod over religious freedom and autonomy and all that stuff. You have to be more careful.
You're right. I know. I'm having an emotional reaction, and I can clearly see you and Rebecca are correct. It's just, sadly, my gut tells me, like, you need to do something strong and hard to get this.
Yeah. You know, the reason that taking a different approach, Jay, is because I've already confronted this issue thoroughly when it comes to things like vaccinations and mandatory vaccination and non-medical exemptions from vaccinations. You know, we've had this whole discussion, you know, internally amongst the science-based medicine guys and myself about where are the limits? What can we get away with? What should we be advocating? You know, can we take a hard line position against non-medical exemptions for vaccinations? What about people who cite religious freedom as a reason not to be vaccinated? There's a public health issue. There's a personal freedom issue. There's the ideal world we would want to live in, and then the realistic world that we could probably get. So this is a deep issue, and so you kind of stepped into a very complicated question. And I'm just trying to give you a little bit of an idea of the kind of issues that come up and realistically what we might be able to accomplish with this sort of thing. It's certainly not saying you have no religious freedom and we get to tell you what to do because that's what science says. But it is an interestingly complex issue when religious freedoms, personal freedoms, and public health issues clash so directly like this. As well as the responsibility directly towards other people, you know?
Yeah.
All right, well, let's move on. Bob, you're going to tell us about the birthday of the emoticon.
Happy birthday. Happy 30th birthday to the emoticon. Emoticons are, of course, representations of facial expressions using letters and punctuations. The intent is to convey emotions and feelings that are usually not expressed with regular flat text. Now, on September 19th, 1982, Carnegie Mellon computer scientist Professor Scott Fahlman made the first smiley using keyboard characters,
And it was really interesting. They actually lost, this email was lost for 20 years, and somebody dug it up. They found some old backup tapes, and they actually recovered the actual email that was used. And in it, he said, "I propose that the following character sequence for jokes markers," and then he does a smiley face, as that we all know. And then he continues, "Read it sideways. Actually, it's probably more economical to mark things that are not jokes, given current trends. For this, use," and then he writes the typical frowny face that we all know. And then, of course, this was so popular that within a matter of months, it spread to the ARPANET and Usenet, and it just caught on like wildfire. One of the interesting things about this is Fallman actually doesn't care. He doesn't really like what emoticons have evolved into. You know, I'm talking about, emoji, I think they're called, or just these graphical representations of his emoticons that he started. He said, "I think they're ugly and they ruin the challenge of trying to come up with a clever way to express emotions using standard keyboard characters." And then I think he kind of felt a little bad about saying that. And he said, "Well, maybe that's just because I invented the other kind."
Yeah, don't be an emoticon snob here, buddy.
The word emoticon itself is a portmanteau word. It's a combination of two words, emotion and icon. And it's also important to point out that this 30th anniversary is celebrating the ASCII emoticon. The typographic emoticons have been around for a lot longer. The first use that I could find was in the National Telegraphic Review and Operation Guide in April 1857. The number 73 in Morse code was said to be used to convey love and kisses, which later kind of morphed into just like best regards. I'm not sure if you would even call that an emoticon. But and this one was really interesting. Abraham Lincoln may have written the first emoticon of sorts in 1862 in a speech transcript that the New York Times transcribed. In the speech, he had in parentheses applause and laughter. And the right parentheses is a winky face. You know, it's a semicolon and a right parentheses. And some people think it's a typo, but other people think that he was trying, you know, he was kind of throwing in like this little weird emoticon thing with what he wrote. So
he also wrote WTF right after that, which is, I believe, the
OMG
instance of that.
There is a skeptical emoticon.
Oh, really? Cool. Well,
and you can click on it. It's in Wikipedia, a list of emoticons, and they have the ASCII emoticons, various versions of them. And the skeptical one is, well, it's the sideways, it's the backslash, or the slash or the backslash, depending on how you want the mouth to sort of skew.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
Represents. You guys ever hear of emojicons?
Yeah, they're way cuter.
It's what you imagine, combinations of emoticons and emoji, letters and punctuation and little graphical images combined. And yeah, obviously it's very flexible. You can do all sorts of crazy stuff with it.
The poop emoji is my favorite.
Oh yeah, I use that all the time. And if somebody gets offended when I send that to them, I said, it's not poop. It's sentient, chocolate pudding.
One more quick news item. We talked last week about the fact that we're going to all be at SciCon, the CSI convention, October 25th to 28th. The SGU is giving a live show on Thursday night, the 25th, and we have an SGU dinner. We'll all be there to chat with you and maybe do some other entertainment. You so sign up for that separately on Saturday, October 27th. And after the dinner, we're also going to do an SGU private recording. These things have turned out to be very popular. We've been doing them at a lot of the live events where we are present. So this will be open to a maximum of 25 individuals to attend a private recording of the SGU. These things are a lot of fun. It's not a live show. It's more typical of the kind of recording that we do when we're, you know, by ourselves, but there'll be a live audience. You can sign up for it on Skeptical Robot. We'll have a link on the show notes. It's $50 to show up at the private recording. Again, we cap it at 25 people. It's been very popular, a lot of fun, very well received the previous times that we've done it. And typically they sell pretty fast. So if you want to be sure to get a spot, I would go quickly to Skeptical Robot. Evan, it's time for Who's That Noisy?
It is, Steve. Thank you once again for reminding me, and I will play for you last week's Who's That Noisy. Here we go. kind of a low sort of humming noise, wouldn't you say?
Yes. I'd say rumbling would be a better term.
Rumbling, yeah, rumbling, noise. Perhaps. A lot of different sorts of descriptors, but does it sound familiar at all?
Yeah, it does. It reminds me of the typical spaceship noise.
Yeah, typical spaceship noise. That's pretty much exactly what it is, Jay. But more specifically, that's the sound the warp core makes aboard the Enterprise.
Awesome! Next generation. Cool!
So, yeah, and there's a 24-hour loop of that noise online that people download or they play in the background just to have it sort of as their background or their walking around music or just, you know, to fall asleep to. And apparently it's relatively popular.
The warp core against the aboard the Next Generation Enterprise.
That's right.
They had that running in the background whenever you were on the engineering in the Enterprise.
Anywhere, I think anywhere in the Enterprise, it sort of was ubiquitous to the.
That was just the background sound of the ship.
The background sound of the ship. We had a few correct guesses from last week. Miranda Richards, listener, is the first one to guess correctly. Thank you, Miranda, and well done. And that clip was submitted by Dr. David Winchester from Florida. Doctor, thank you very much.
What do you got for this week, Evan?
Listen to this.
I know many GPs who now endorse using homeopathy alongside the conventional medicine that they propose. And we're not saying that homeopathy is instead of life-saving treatment. We're saying that actually it can save money, it can save time, and I think people need to consider that.
Oh, my God, really?
Yep.
Seriously.
Utter rubbish, I say.
You could save money and save time by giving people water for a cure.
Give it a guess and send us an email, info@theskepticsguide.org.
Well, thanks, Evan. All right, let's go on to our interview. Well, we are sitting here now at TAM 2012 with Dr. Pamela Gay. Pamela, welcome back to the Skeptics Guide.
Well, thank you so much for having me on again.
And for those who don't know, Pamela does an amazing podcast called Astronomy Cast, one of my favorites. But tell us what you were talking about here at TAM this year.
Well, I was trying mostly to focus on how human beings can do amazing things to make the world better and fix the things that are broken by getting engaged in society. And there's so many different aspects to this, from helping scientists accomplish science in our current funding crisis by going online and participating in citizen science, by being aware of things that they can help support through just writing an email. There was a fifth grader a few weeks ago who was forbidden to give a speech on same-sex marriage by an extraordinarily judgmental principal. And the internet outcry allowed this kid to be able to give his speech in a special assembly. And simply by looking around and saying, I'm going to do something to change what bothers me instead of simply whining about it on Twitter, we're capable of doing really great things as a society working as individuals.
But whining is so much easier, though.
And that's the problem. I mean, we've all forwarded a tweet about something that where someone was articulating something that bothered them, but never taken the moment to do something original, to donate to a cause. One of the things that greatly frustrates me is there's been a few times with 365 Days of Astronomy, which is a community-based podcast that I work with. We've put out a call for donations and seen huge numbers of retweets and zero donations.
Yes.
It's so easy to just forward, to just repeat, and so much harder to put your time, your money, your effort into actually doing things that you say matter for you. Imagine if all the time and energy that went into going to some YouTube video where someone's being an idiot and then trolling them for it instead went into doing something positive to educate people so that they don't become trolls.
So is being a troll a trap? Do you think there's something that attracts people to it, like they get an adrenaline rush or something? You know, what's the driver?
People want attention. I for a while volunteered as a dog trainer, and I went through courses to get trained as a dog. And one of
you
not
got trained,
trained
as
a dog. Sorry, to get trained as a dog trainer, and to think like a dog, which is don't conjoin those two sentences. It comes out strangely. I just tried that. And one of the things that they they teach you is some of these animals misbehave horribly, biting, nipping, yapping, peeing on the floor, because they just desperately want attention. They're herd, they're not herd animals, they're pack animals, and they, if you have a single dog, it's isolated. It wants to feel part of the pack, and negative attention is still attention. Mm-hmm. And trolls, when you feed them by saying, you're wrong, you're bad, you're evil, you're wasting my time, and you attack them back, you're feeding them, you're giving in to their need for attention to feel part of the pack. We need to figure out how not to give them that positive reinforcement.
Wait, is it as simple as just ignore?
I think you sometimes have to do more than just ignore, because if you just ignore, they're still sitting there and other people are going to give in and feed. I think that it's worth taking the half second before you close that browser window to hit the block, to hit the report as abuse, to hit that button that will eventually alert the social network, this is someone we probably need to remove. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's a certain threshold of trolling that you just need to ban people.
Yeah.
Because they're and you said the don't feed the trolls. When you say that, that's feeding the trolls, first of all. Mm-hmm. Right? You can't talk about not talking about it without talking about it. and that feeds them to a certain degree. And again, someone gives in. Because they will just escalate their game until then someone caves.
Yeah.
And the other thing is, like, if you start with certain sites, like if you're running a science site and you have somebody there spreading pseudoscience, you can't let it go unanswered.
Right.
So you have this dilemma where you have this rank pseudoscience on a science site that's not no one's objecting to, or you have to feed the troll, or you just ban them. So you're almost obligated at some point just to ban people to preserve the integrity of the blog.
This is something that we have to deal with the CosmoQuest forums, which recently merged with the Bad Astronomy Universe Today forums. And we get a lot of people coming into the forums and presenting their alternative to the mainstream ideas mm-hmm. about science. These are people that are trying to say relativity isn't true or presenting their own alternative ideas. And so we have an area set aside for their discussion.
Yeah.
And they're required to answer every question that is given to them. And they're given 30 days to convince people of their idea. And if they can't, they have to be silenced. The thread is closed.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So it's a way of confronting it, but giving them their own space.
Yeah.
That's interesting. I mean, you're basically saying we're going to allot you time mm-hmm. to talk about it, mm-hmm. but then if it doesn't actually get to the point where it goes above the waterline, which, and I'm curious to know if it ever does.
So far it hasn't, and this is a forum that has existed within the Bat Astronomy Universe Today name, the Bat Forums, for many, many years. And when Fraser Cain first set up this part of the forum, it was with the hope that maybe some new, novel, interesting idea would come out of it that was real science, and it never has.
Did he come up with that idea?
I think it was a combination of seeing all of these pseudoscience ideas, seeing all of these alternative ideas being brought forward and getting smashed down in a way that led to flames, trying to create out of all of these flame wars something positive.
Right. Well, I think it's a really cool idea. I'd actually like to come take a look. Mm-hmm.
In terms of people getting involved in changing the world, which obviously we like to do, we're activists. I do find that the people come up to us to talk about it sort of sort into one of two categories. There are the people who say, you guys should do this.
Yes.
Right? Like, this is a great idea. You guys should go ahead and do that. My answer is always, yeah, that is a good idea. You should do that. Why don't you do that? We're doing something already.
Yeah.
But there are a lot of people who do ask questions at lectures or who come up and talk to us and say, I want to get involved. I want to do something. Can you help me do that? So we don't want to make it seem like other people are not interested in being activists, but sometimes you just don't know how to get involved.
There's two different factors. The people who come up to us and say, you need to, make me feel exhausted. Because we can only do so much as individuals, mm-hmm. but part of what we're seeing is these people see us as strong, powerful people who are capable of enacting change, and they don't see themselves that way.
Right. Yeah.
And so we have to empower people to understand that when they see a problem, when they're upset about something, they actually can be that cliche of be the change you want to see in the world. And so we need to somehow facilitate people believing in themselves. And the other side of that is there's a lot of people who recognize that there's a lot of badness out there, and they don't know where to start. It's all so intimidating.
Right.
They don't know how to get involved. And my advice to these people is simply find what you're passionate about, and then Google to find out who's already engaged in combating this. One of my favorite examples is people who get very upset about lesbian, gay, bisexual, queer, transgender issues. I don't remember what order those words are supposed to go in now. There's this fabulous It Gets Better project. So if you see, and people see this on my comment thread, because my last name's Gay, so every good comment thread eventually leads to somebody saying, ha ha, this is so gay, her last name's Gay, you're gay. And it's ridiculous that this is still happening in 2012.
Yeah. Wow. But that could be an 11-year-old, right? Because it's online.
It's online. Yeah. Right. It was
me.
Hey, just kidding. But this is one of those cases where there's clearly still problems. There was that teenage girl killed in Texas for being in love with another girl.
Yeah.
And there's already an organization working hard to do good, to fix things. So find the people who are doing the thing that causes you to stay awake going, I can't believe the world is broken in this way.
Right.
And embrace those people. And if those people aren't already out there doing the thing that makes you passionately hurt so that you want to change the world, be that person. Elise Anders did that a few years ago, creating the Hug Me, I'm Vaccinated program when she realized how much we're losing herd immunity.
Mm-hmm.
So you can, if you don't see the people already out there working to make things better, be that person who starts the grassroots movement.
Or if you don't have the time, or you're just not cut out for it, which, let's be honest,
yeah,
some people aren't. Like you said earlier, though, you can also be a supporter, not just by digesting the content and learning from it, but you can donate.
Mm-hmm.
And even just sending an email to the people that are doing the work that you really appreciate and thank them and let them know. Because, you know, as someone that receives emails where people say, hey, I listen and I appreciate it, it fuels us and it really makes a difference. You know, if you're just in an echo chamber and you have no idea if you're having an impact, then, you know, you don't know what's going on, and you could easily just putter out and not be motivated.
And in our current society, we're in a position where our government just can't fund things the way it used to. And I know I personally am in this situation where I'm really worried because I didn't get the grant I was counting on this year. I need to figure out how to afford my lead programmer because his funding runs out in December.
Mm-hmm.
And all of this is terrifying, but then I see hope in things like there are so many individuals who have things that they can share, resources that they can share, and they're working so hard to literally build our rocket plane future.
Mm-hmm.
NASA right now is underfunded, to say the least. But there's so many individuals who made their fortunes in dot-coms, working with Amazon, with Google, with PayPal, with all these different corporations. And having made their money, they're now saying, I'm going to build the rocket plane future by hiring the engineers, by hiring the spacesuit designers. And this is where we see SpaceX, Blue Origins, X-Corps, all these other companies. Because someone of means said, I'm going to change the world. And what we have to hope for is that people of means will recognize what we're doing. And of means, maybe one extra dollar.
Mm-hmm.
It only takes 10 people with one extra dollar to pay for 1 hour of a student doing something in my lab.
Yeah, right.
And every $1 can go so far.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe someday we'll get lucky. And I know we've been lucky with Astronomy Cast. We have Uncle Bob as one of our sponsors.
Mm-hmm.
And he supports what we do, spreading the word of astronomy. And you have supporters who support you. And we live in an age where it's individuals who fund changing society virally one idea and campaign at a time. It's one of those strange contradictions in modern society where there's the expectation that with intellectual gifts and content that we should give it away for free, and that if we expect to earn money that we are being selfish, that we are name one of the seven sins. We are somehow taking advantage of society by trying to make a decent living. And there's something wrong with the idea that it's okay for an athlete who entertains on TV and in the sports arena, an actress, all of these people to get paid huge sums of money to do what they do. One baseball player's salary for 1 year, for one of the little guys making $1 million a year, that funds my entire staff, multiple individuals, for multiple years.
Right.
And people see it as wrong that we as academics would like to make a reasonable living, that we as content producers might even put ads on our websites,
right,
and try not to have to pay out of pocket for our microphones. That's what Fraser and I do. Fraser and I do all of our podcasting out of our own pocket, and we pay an audio engineer and we pay someone to do transcripts for us, because really, if you don't pay someone to do transcripts, you're torturing them.
Right, right.
And it's...
it's frustrating, and it's something that we've all hit, that we've all hit that wall. And it's funny, when I was just talking to Brian Dunning about it, you know, it's like, yeah, you know, it's just another year throwing the money away, burning the money on our hobby, quote unquote hobby. But now Brian is doing it full time, and he's really under the gun. He's really, really working it. So, you know, hopefully there are a lot of people that, that do donate money. Even though, it, you know, like you said, the dollar or whatever, and that does count. And we, of course, we all, like Bob was saying, would love a bigger infusion so we don't have to focus on it as much.
You made another point that I thought was very good, the fact that often our listeners or people out there in the public may perceive us as having some kind of special power or access or something, that we can get things done that they can't. And I think that... and we've marveled at that too. People come up to us at conferences, or they write it, they send us emails, and there's this tone that makes it seem like they think like we're all part of one big organization, which is not the case. We're all just individuals, or that somehow we have some magical access to government or whatever. It's like, yeah, why aren't you telling the FDA how to fix this? Because like, I'm just a citizen. I have no special access to anyone or anything. And, you know, we just started doing this in our living room. You know, we're there's absolutely no reason why you can't do the exact same thing. It's all just energy and drive, you know. But that there is, I think that becomes this artificial barrier that people think they can't do something, or that's something magical about what we're doing.
And this is where I deeply appreciate the fluffy segments that are at the end of the news so often, where they show the 12-year-old who raised a couple thousand dollars for this foundation or the
lemonade stand.
Right. And so there's so many small ways and giant ways. And I'd encourage everyone to take the time to listen to TED Talks, not the ones by the big name academics, but by the ones by the individuals who've seen a problem. One of my favorite ones, it's such a simple, complex concept, was realizing that there's a serious problem of not having soap in the third world. Such a simple thing, not having soap. And then was visiting the United States and seeing that they throw out, and they do this here in the South Point, a bar of soap every day. You open the soap, you use the soap, and the next morning it's gone, and you have a new bar of soap.
Right.
Well, he worked out a program to gather up all these hotel soaps, clean them, and redistribute them.
Clean soap?
I don't know how that part works. Physical scientist, not chemist or biologist.
You need super soap.
You just put Medisoap. Water. I think you just put water on it and agitate it.
Probably,
it
that's what I'm
guessing. Outer layer.
Yeah.
So, Pamela, thanks for being open with us and talking with us. And it's, of course, always a pleasure to see you at these conferences.
It was really my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me on.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fictitious, and I challenge my panelists of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. I think we have an interesting lineup this week. Are you guys ready?
Yep.
Yeah.
All right. Item number one, astronomers may have solved the missing baryon problem with the discovery of a halo of hot gas surrounding the Milky Way galaxy. Item number two, this year's peak Arctic ice melt is the greatest since records have been kept and likely the greatest in a million years. And item number three, physicists have built a four-dimensional space-time crystal that can be used to keep perfect time until the end of the universe. Rebecca, go first.
I'm being punished. Last week, I had read all of them. This week, space-time crystals. Baryon problems. You just took these from a Star Trek episode that you watched. None of these have any relevance to anything that I have read in the last 30 years.
So in a way, they don't exist. In a way.
I don't know what the missing baryon problem is. So I don't know how difficult that might be to solve. Halo of hot gas around the Milky Way galaxy. Why not? So I don't know. I have literally not a single clue. Peak Arctic ice melt, greatest since records have been kept, and likely the greatest in a million years. That's a lot of years. So that seems like a ridiculous number of years. And so I'm very skeptical of that one, only because a million is a lot. And a four-dimensional space-time crystal that can be used to keep perfect time until the end of the universe. Yeah, that's some straight-up Doctor Who shit right there, Steve. And I
phone booth.
I have been watching a lot of Doctor Who recently.
Yeah. Or, like, did Lex Luthor make this to trap Superman's soul in?
General Zod is flying around in space in one of these things.
Right. Oh, until the end of the universe. That's where that came from. Not keeping time, keeping General Zod trapped. Until the end of the universe. Oh, God. I really don't know. I don't know. A million years. Four-dimensional space-time crystal. Missing baryon problem. I have absolutely no idea. I feel like maybe a million years is just crazy enough to work. Maybe that's why you picked that, because you thought it would throw us off, because it's a lot of years. So I'm gonna go with the missing baryon problem. I don't know what the hell that is, but I'm gonna say, you know what? It's unsolvable.
Okay, Evan?
Yeah, I wasn't aware of a missing baryon problem. Probably Bob was, but you know, that's Bob. That's how he rolls. With the discovery of a halo of hot gas surrounding the Milky Way galaxy. Okay, so we've got this thing I know called like the Oort cloud, and we've got other things that are way out there, the heliopause and the helios. Sure, why not there be a, you know, halo of hot gas that... So I actually think that one's plausible. The Arctic ice melt, greatest since records have been kept. Likely the greatest in a million years. Don't know about that. A million years, long time. I really don't know how they're able to say it's likely to be the greatest in a million years. I get it since records have been kept, but I don't know. Something's wrong. Something's a little strange about that one. The four-dimensional space-time crystal used to keep perfect time. I'll say this one is science, but look, if I had a four-dimensional space-time crystal, I wouldn't be doing something like keeping time with it. You know, I'd be blowing up enemy planets and just running around space and going through wormholes and doing all kinds of cool stuff rather than keeping time until the end of the universe. How boring. I think that one's so boring that that one's true. So I'm going to go with the Arctic ice melt one. That one's fiction.
The four-dimensional space-time crystal is boring?
It's boring in the context that you're going to use it to keep time? Duh.
All right.
Big deal.
Yeah, I get that. That's a good point.
Bob?
Okay. Missing baryon problem. Well, that's cool if they solve that. That's... because it was missing, and now they don't know where it is. No, that's really cool. I mean,
so we're looking for it.
Call off that APB.
I mean, baryons are. I mean, I don't know if you want me to go into any detail, Steve, but just what I know about that problem. But so that's cool. That's really cool, and I don't think it's necessarily an extra. You know, it's cool, but it's not like that's an impossible type of thing. I could buy that. It's really awesome. I can't wait to hear some details. Let's see, the peak Arctic ice melt. Yeah, record lows, sure. Million years, wow, that's a lot. Possibly. I mean, are they really confident of what the lowest points were for a million years? Wow, I guess it's not horrifically surprising. The third one, four-dimensional space-time crystal can be used to keep perfect time till the end of the universe. Wow. Well, the problem I have with that is those two words have built. Yeah, I mean, I could see them theorizing about something like that and maybe even figuring out kind of how they would do something like that, but actually building it? No. I mean, that's what the crux is for that one. So for that main reason, I'm going to say that one's fiction.
That's a good point. I want to change my answer.
We have an even distribution.
Yeah, I'm kind of convinced.
So you're the tiebreaker, Jay.
Yeah, there's no way that we built something that's going to last till the end of time. There's just that's the first. As soon as you sent it over, I realized that one was the fake. I wish that you picked me first this time, because of course it sounds like I'm just doing a GWB here.
Sure does.
But I'm not. I'm doing a GWF, which is I'm going to go with being first, because I thought of that before Bob did. Thank you.
Okay. So, we've got Bob and Jay at number three. guess we'll take these in order. Astronomers Damn have it. Solved the missing baryon problem. The discovery of a halo of Iron Cat surrounding the Milky Way galaxy. Rebecca, you think this one is the fiction?
No, I don't. I wanted to change.
Solid good reasons, I must say. And the rest of you think this one is science, and this one is science.
Guess screw.
So,
hello, baryons.
Yeah, the missing baryon problem. So, scientists, astronomers have a pretty good idea of how many baryons. That's ordinary matter like protons, neutrons, as opposed to bosons like the Higgs boson. So they had a pretty good idea of how many baryons were in the early universe after the Big Bang, shortly after the Big Bang. And they have an idea of how many baryons we can see out there today. And there's only about half of the baryons that there should be. Half of the baryons are missing. They don't know where they
Uh-oh.
Are.
We have a missing baryon problem.
Yes.
Yes, literally.
Now, they've hypothesized that perhaps if these baryons are not in the galaxies that we can see, and to be clear, this has nothing to do with dark matter, if the missing baryons are not in the galaxies that we can see, maybe they comprise a network of gaseous clouds that stretches between the galaxies and the galaxy clusters. But that's just been hypothesized. So now the Chandra X-ray Observatory has observed a halo of fairly hot gas surrounding the Milky Way galaxy. They estimate that it has a radius, like imagine a sphere, a bubble of gas with a radius of about 300,000 light years, though it may be Whoa. Even further.
Wow.
And that the Wow. mass... The baryon mass in that cloud is about equal to the mass of the Milky Way galaxy itself. And so, bingo, bango, there's your missing baryons.
Hey, is your problem. Hey, someone your problem. This baryon.
Okay. You know, I'm friends with somebody at the Chandra Observatory,
yeah.
and I bet I'm going to get shit for this later.
Bob, how hot is this gas, do you know?
I bet you it's very diffuse, but very hot.
Yeah, between 1 and 2.5 million kelvins.
Whoa. Yeah,
that'll burn you.
Hotter than the surface of the sun.
But it won't because it's so diffuse, as Bob said, so there's not that much actual energy there. Let's go on to number two. This year's peak Arctic ice melt is the greatest since records have been kept, and likely the greatest in a million years. Evan, you think this is the fiction.
I
Everyone else
do.
Thinks it's science. And this one is science.
Oh,
woo.
Damn. Oh my God.
High five.
Every year, the Arctic ice melts through the end of the summer. We just passed the peak ice melt, the smallest that the Arctic ice mass gets at this time of year. And it is smaller, or the ice melt has been the greatest, since we've been keeping specific records for the last 33 years. The previous record was set on September 18th, 2007. So this is now... Again, has broken any previous records. And those scientists who study such things estimate that this is probably the smallest the Arctic ice sheet has been in the last million years. So obviously that's not a direct measurement, of course, but that's their extrapolation.
Global warming, bah!
Yeah.
Someday if they prove this wrong, then I'll be able to get a pass on this science or fiction.
Someday.
Someday.
And, of course, they're worried about the fact that this is approaching some sort of tipping point, where it's going to be have significant impact on the climate that's going to reinforce the whole global warming situation. So one of the scientists involved with this study, Yackel, said that he predicts that the Arctic sea ice could be completely gone in the summers within the next 20 to 25 years. So obviously it would still come back in the winter, but by the Arctic sea ice may completely disappear if the trend continues. Of course, that's always the rub, but it certainly seems to be the way things are going.
And therefore,
physicists have built a four-dimensional space-time crystal that could be used to keep perfect time until the end of the universe. And this one is the fiction. And Bob, you obviously read this news item. Bob's like, I don't know, man. I think they, they theorized about this, but they haven't built it yet, which of course is exactly correct.
I can't stand it. I actually thought that when I read, I knew this.
Good job.
I didn't read it.
All right.
And I, of course they didn't build it.
I would have said that even if I didn't read it.
A likely story.
I'm not kidding. Right. They built a four-dimensional crystal. I mean,
it could happen.
No. And Steve, you blew it. Steve, you blew it, man. What you should have said was to make it even more or less believable was that it could survive the heat death of the universe. Because when I first read that, I was like, what? It's going to survive the heat death? But then it makes
sense. Let's not get crazy.
Once you read it, yeah. No, you should have included
I know.
That.
Well, I thought the end of the universe was a little bit more punchy, but whatever.
Okay.
Don't tell him how to do his job.
Physicists have... Hey, I got 50% of you. That's a good day for me. Physicists have indeed figured out, theoretically, how they might create this four-dimensional space-time crystal. So this was theorized previously, but the physicists didn't know how they could create it. Now they've come up with a way where it might work. What they do is they create a weak static magnetic field, and then they use this to trap ions, and then they say the persistent rotation of the trapped ions produces temporal order, leading to the formation of a space-time crystal at the lowest quantum energy state.
And that's the key right there.
That's the key.
It could survive the heat death of the universe because it's at its lowest quantum energy state, so therefore it can't go any lower, and it'll persist even after, you know, essentially the universe is dead, the heat death.
Yes, and it will keep perfect time indefinitely.
Now, could you wear this?
Yeah, well, maybe, around your neck like Flava Flav.
Maybe if you were a couple hundred kilometers wide, or probably would need to be big, I would think, to infuse that into this space-time fabric.
That's it. Space-time crystal has now entered the lexicon.
So it's not going to be an app anytime soon.
But I do agree, Rebecca, that this thing clearly would be powering the TARDIS.
Yeah, totally.
Absolutely.
Well, you're missing the point, but okay, I'll go with it.
Yeah. Oh, thanks, Bob.
You're just all happy and chatty because you won this week.
Yeah, I do get happy and chatty when I win.
All right, well, good job, Bob and Jay.
Thank you.
Jay, you got a quote for us this week.
I do. I have a quote that was sent in by a listener named James Capich from Adelaide, South Australia. And he sent me a really cool quote, and it's the guy who came up with this quote has a really cool name, and I'll tell you why. I was listening to the way his name is pronounced in French, and it reads nothing like the guy's actual name. In English, his name is Albert Camus, and in French, his name is
Albert Camus.
That's exactly the way the guy says it on Wikipedia. So it's pretty cool. I listened to it like 10 times. Albert Camus. So the quote is...
Finally.
An intellectual? Yes. And never deny it. An intellectual is someone whose mind watches itself. I like this because I am happy to be both halves, the watcher and the watched. Can they be brought together? This is a practical question. We must get down to it. I despise intelligence really means I cannot bear my doubts.
Albert Camus.
Yeah, that was a good quote.
Yeah,
that's good in French. Yeah.
You know, whose mind watches itself is another way of saying metacognition, which is thinking about thinking. Yep. Cool.
And real quick, he was an author, a journalist, and a philosopher.
Three good things.
You're welcome, Steve.
I have an announcement. Yes. Sorry.
Of course.
Real quick. Coming. That's
real
why I delayed
quick,
in my, you're welcome.
Quick,
you're
sorry.
You're pregnant.
No. Oh, although actually,
wait for that announcement.
I was literally just looking at my IP free app, which is a period tracking app. It's not working right.
TMI.
I thought it made me think I was like a week late, but it turns out it's just dumb. It's doing it wrong. So anyway,
upgrade that firmware there.
We mentioned SciCon, and I have mentioned on previous episodes that Richard Wiseman, John Ronson, and I are heading out on the road, to Nashville, October 20th. We leave, from Amherst, New York, CSI headquarters. We now have events scheduled all the way down to Nashville. So October 20th, will be in Cleveland, Ohio that evening. Evening of the 21st in Columbus, Ohio, 22nd Cincinnati, 23rd Louisville, Kentucky. You can, if you want to come to one of those public events and hang out with us, you can learn more at paranormalroadtrip.org. Click on itinerary. That's it.
Who's doing the driving?
That would be our camera person, Adam.
Yeah, because you don't drive, and you have two British guys riding with you.
Well, yeah, you let them drive. You don't know where you're going
to
wind up.
Well, John knows how to drive in the U.S., so he might
do
some
driving.
You're
so lost, Rebecca. You are so lost.
I'm a good navigator, so that's what counts.
You're a navigator. All right. Well, thanks for joining me this week, everyone.
Thank you, Steve.
Yeah, well done this week.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. You can also check out our other podcast, the SGU 5x5, as well as find links to our blogs and the SGU forums. For questions, suggestions and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website, or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by leaving us a review on iTunes, Zune, or your portal of choice.